How many of you were baptized as an infant? Raise your hand. So, Catholic? Yes? Lutheran? Now, we ask the question, you? Catholic? You Methodist? Baptized as infants? Mary? You're not sure? Yeah, that's the deal when you do it. When you're working with babies, recall's not so great. Okay, now here's the reason I asked that question. This is, you know, you weren't prompted. I didn't know who was going to be here tonight. But here's a fair question. Why is it that the church would practice infant baptism and people would say, well, it depends upon your tradition? Because how many of you here were not baptized as infants? Okay, so Baptist, 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 Mennonite, there you go. All right, so you have baptism as adults or after becoming a believer, and you see that predominantly in the Baptist tradition. Then over here, you've got something like infant baptism, which doesn't seem to be bound to by any tradition. Roman Catholic, Reformed, Methodist, Lutheran, Episcopalians, you would find infant baptism in all of those traditions. So that's just, I just want you to think about that. Why then, or from whence comes infant baptism when, I think all of you know, regardless of your tradition, doesn't come, at least not clearly, out of the Bible. Nowhere in here does the Bible say baptize infants. So why could you have a common practice that comfortably crosses such vast traditional denominational traditions? How is that possible? Where does it find its root? And really what we talked about 2 weeks ago is where it finds its root. Because while there is very little in common between the Roman Catholics and the Reformed tradition, very little in common between the Mennonites and the Episcopalians, why then would they share that in common? And the answer isn't found, again, in a scriptural reference, but it's found in a shared doctrine of the church. They share a common ecclesiology. And that ecclesiology is the one we looked at 2 weeks ago. It's the first one we talked about. And I brought it back up. Here are the three views. And replacement theology, how you understand Israel and the church, identified by that theology, is the theology of the Roman Catholic, the Methodist, the Lutheran, the Reformed Church, the Episcopalian Church, and the Mennonites. They all have a replacement theology. In other words, the church has replaced Israel. Now you begin to understand why infant baptism could cross all those traditions with this shared perspective, because all of them would say in one form or another that baptism is the new circumcision. Israel circumcised, the church has replaced Israel, and replacing circumcision is infant baptism. Now, it's not that simple in any of those traditions, but that's why you see something common among such broad tradition span, okay? It really does come down to what is your view of Israel. Now, we looked at already the replacement view 2 weeks ago. Tonight, we're going to look at the classic and the progressive dispensational view. But let's do just a really quick review of what replacement theology is, all right? Replacement theology view, it's answering the question, what's the relationship between the church and Israel? And here's the belief. The church is made up of all the people of God of all time. Israel has been replaced by the church as the people of God, and the church inherits the promises of Israel that is also known as supersessionism. All right, so it's the idea that Israel was God's chosen people in the Old Testament, just for simplicity's sake, and now in the New Testament, Israel has been replaced by the church. All the blessings that belonged to Israel, that were promised to Israel in any of the covenants, all of those blessings now belong to the church. And so you'll see then, those who hold to this view, regardless of the tradition, will comfortably reach into the Old Testament and pull into their faith practice more Jewish traditions. Again, infant baptism replaced circumcision. Anytime you see a church that seems to be comfortable with, and this would pretty much drive you only into Roman Catholicism, though a little bit into the higher order churches like Episcopalianism, where you have priests. Again, you say, well, where'd that come from? And it doesn't come clearly from a text in Scripture. It comes from their doctrine of the church. The church replaced Israel. Israel had priests. We have priests. You'll see it in the handling of the Lord's Supper. If you come from a Baptist tradition, which is not typically replacement theology, the Lord's Supper becomes almost entirely symbolic. It's a remembrance. When you step back into replacement theology, you'll see that expressed at the Lord's table. They'll use different language. In the Catholic Church, it actually becomes a new sacrifice. In the Reformed Church, it becomes sacramental. And so you'll see language attached to it. It becomes a means of grace. You'll see language attached to it. You say, where do they get that from? And you can't turn to like page 286 in your Bible, but you get it from borrowing those type of images, borrowing those type of pictures from the Old Testament. You say, well, what gives them liberty to do that? Because they're the new Israel. And so conveniently, they grab and pull forward. Now, I would argue that one of the weaknesses of that, and we talked about the weaknesses a couple of weeks ago, is that they're borrowing from that is a matter of convenience. It is very convenient to borrow from Israel all the promises God made them. It's not so convenient to say, well, what about all those curses that he promised Israel when they were disobedient? And suddenly we're people of the new covenant, and we're people of grace, and now we're not Israel anymore. So there's a matter of convenience that I see attached to the reaching back and pulling these symbols forward and making them more than just symbolic, making them almost effectual. All right? So that's replacement theology. We worked through that a couple of weeks ago, and it really is, many of you, about half of you tonight, it is the tradition you were raised in, though you probably never heard it, because you really didn't talk about in a class what's our relationship to Israel. You see, in that camp, in this camp, and let's just say even in for more broader context for us, typically in the Reform camp, you don't talk about what happened to Israel. You are what happened to Israel. It's not something you talk about. You are it. And so it doesn't come up. Now, when you move into tonight's discussion, it's all about Israel. All right, let's move on. Let's talk now about the classical dispensational view. And again, this is a theological perspective, not of salvation. We're not talking about dispensational salvation, but the dispensational view, meaning that God dealt with Israel in that dispensation, he deals with the church in this dispensation, and inevitably there's a future coming dispensation or dealing with both the church and Israel, that there is a dealing with them throughout all of history. And so we'll see that tonight. Here's how it's defined. The church is the body of believers. Now watch, the church is distinct from Israel. The church is indwelt by the Holy Spirit. Israel was not indwelt by the Holy Spirit. The church is distinct from Israel in that way. Also, the church is distinct because it actually began on the day of Pentecost. In Acts chapter 2, you've heard this, the birthday of the church. The church began. When you hear that language, it may just be not very well thought out language, but in many cases, if it's well thought out, they're telling you what their theology is. They're telling you that they are not Israel. They are something new, born on the day of Pentecost. Now, ethnic Israel still has a future. In the dispensational theology view, there's still a future for ethnic Israel. They are on the shelf. That's the way we would say it. They're on the shelf for now, but God hasn't forgotten them. John?
What's a dispensation?
A dispensation can have various meanings, but in this we're talking about periods of time, or most more particularly, periods in which God relates to people a certain way. So he related, for instance, God had a relationship with Adam and Eve in the garden, and that relationship had construct around it, which we would say was the covenant of works. This is all of yours, it's all free to you, and it all belongs to you unless or until you violate this restriction of eating that tree. So Adam and Eve were always on probation. There was a covenant made with them, it's all yours, if. And when they broke that covenant, they lost that relationship. So that's a dispensation. That's how God related to humankind in that period. Then that introduces us into the dispensation which was reintroduced at Noah, the Noahic covenant, and you can usually follow the dispensations in this classic theology through the covenants. Yes. Well, it's one way of framing them, but dispensation simply means either a period of time or, how could I say it, the purpose of time. A little bit like we say the age of accountability. You've heard that term related to salvation. What's the age of accountability? Well, we would say that's not a good term. It's better to talk about what is the, what would you say? Not age of accountability, but how would you say that differently? Because it's not about age. What's it about? You're drawing a blank? We just did this in soteriology. Okay? The Bible doesn't teach an age of accountability. Romans 1 doesn't talk about an age of accountability. But there's a period of understanding, right? A place where a person's now held accountable because they now understand. So it's not an age, it's a period. It's a relationship. A little bit like that same thing. What do you say? It's like a dispensation. Okay? I don't know if I'm answering that well, but see, the reason I don't want us to get hung up here. The reason this is a bump in the road is because there are two conversations happening typically in a Christian context with that word dispensationalism. The one conversation is that God deals with Israel differently than he deals now with the church. And what they mean by that, there's one way to be saved in the Old Testament. There was another way to be saved now under the New Covenant. Those are dispensations of God's relationship concerning how we are saved. And that's one version of dispensational conversation that's going on. We're not having that conversation. We're having the conversation of how God has, through history, dealt distinctly with his people and how he has called them or related to them. And you'll see those dispensations tonight on several graphs. So that's the kind of dispensation we're talking about. It's a word that's used in various formats. Tonight we're talking about periods of time defined by how God related to his people during that period of time, not how his people were saved. I think it'll be clearer tonight. There was a hand back there. A forgiveness of a period of time. Oh, I see, yeah. So again, it's a period of time in which God relates differently or has different terms that he applies to humankind during that period of time. And see, that moves us back closer to how we relate to him in faith, and we're not talking about that. That's that other conversation that's running along. Let's press on and see if this doesn't clear up. I feel like we're in mud here. Well, let's press on. Let's see if this clears up a little bit. Replacement theology, we looked at already, is the oldest branch of church theology. If you go back to our church fathers, that's what you're going to find is replacement theology. And then it is still theologically adaptable to the church at large, though it's arguably now no longer the most common position. Well, now, much, much, much later, we have this idea of dispensationalism coming in. Now, one of the biggest criticisms against dispensationalism in any form is that it's new. And it's like, what did the church do for the first 1900 years? Were they just ignorant? Did they have no idea about Israel? Now, we touched on this last week for just a moment. One of the reasons why the common reasoning regarding Israel was that they are not is because during all of this period, they were not. They weren't a nation. There was no acknowledged, definable ethnicity that we would call Jews. They had been so broadly and widely dispersed that you couldn't identify them. But in 1948, they kind of like started coming out of the closet, right? And they were reestablished not just ethnically, but nationally. And then Christian theologians, scholars, just Christians in the pew had to say, we have to ask a question here we never even had to ask 20 years ago. Nobody wondered what happened to Israel, other than we wondered what happened to them. But nobody wondered whether or not they had any future, because it seemed that they were always in the past tense. So that's one of the reasons this is so new. But this is a problem you'll never get past, that God seemed to be silent about the relationship between the church and Israel for 1900 years. And you stub your toe on that one. All right. Here are the most common dispensations, John. The Old Testament age, the New Testament church age, the tribulation period, the millennial kingdom, and then the new heaven and new earth. Those would be periods of time in which God relates to his people, identifies them, and deals with them, we're going to say, in a certain way. In the Old Testament age, it was ethnic Israel. No one debates that. The Old Testament, God was relating to his people, and his people were Israel. Again, we're not talking about how he related to them. That's soteriology. But that he related to them. They are his people. And now, today, in the New Testament age, the church is his people. And the church is made up of believing Gentiles, but that's not all, right? Also, believing Israel, which we might call true Israel. Now, this era is the era in which we all live. And until there was, again, a national Israel, there was no reason to put that bar there. There was no reason to even have it in a discussion. So it was very simple in 1918 to have a class like this and say, in the Old Testament, God's people were Israel. In the New Testament age, today, God's people are the believing Gentiles we know as the church. What about the Jews? Well, that same period, remember, that same period, say 1918, the Christian conversation didn't include ethnic Israel. It had very little interest in ethnic Israel. And if ethnic Israel came up, it was in an anti-Semitic context. There was no rejoicing over Israel, grieving over Israel, or hope for Israel. So it really would not be even a bar there. Say, well, what about people like the Apostle Paul, who was an ethnic Jew who became, right, a member of the church? Well, the anti-Semitic crowd would go so far to say that he effectively became a Gentile because his nation ceased to exist. He was dispossessed of his people. And they would see his language that way even in the New Testament letters. He seems to be a man dispossessed from his people. All right. Now, there is coming a tribulation period. Now, this is dispensational view, and it has only one purpose. There's only one purpose for the 7 years that many would see the book of Revelation teaching. There's only one purpose for that. It has nothing to do with the church. It is the calling out of ethnic Israel. It is the reestablishing of that identity as God's people on this earth. All right? So, this is a eschatological period. This is a period where, say, the Reformed tradition, like I just think of Pastor Craig, he didn't have any reason to ever think about that growing up. And the reason is because there was no reason to think about a future for Israel. What Craig probably didn't know when he was 20 was that he had a replacement theology. The kind of language wasn't even discussed, I'm guessing there, Craig. But now we're realizing that there has to be a different theological perspective, or you would have no reason to have that. The only reason to have that is for that, to give Israel the opportunity to respond. And we would go to the book of Revelation. We've done that here. That's how we teach it. It's what it says. It says 144,000 Jews are going to be called forth, 12,000 from all 12 tribes. I believe that's what it means. And from that 144,000 Jews, a great gospel evangelistic thrust will go out to all of Israel. There will be a great, treacherous, devastating persecution against Israel by the world ruler of the day, the Antichrist. Every attempt will be made to destroy her, but it will fall short because God has prepared a place for her. He will carry her to that place and protect her and feed her when she couldn't work and couldn't eat otherwise. All of that is to reestablish Israel as his chosen people, or best said, to reaffirm the promises he made to Israel. Then that ushers in the millennial kingdom, but we've got this interesting little thing here, and I didn't put the name on that. Somebody tell me what that is. What is that? That's the rapture. All right? If this is all about Israel, then the question is, what happens to the church? And the answer is, she's not here. She was taken to be with the Lord. That's a 7-year wedding celebration in heaven, in preparation for a wedding, I should better say. Okay? So this is all the church is taken out and then dropped back in again during that millennial kingdom, where you will have forever, starting with the first 1,000 years and inevitably ushering into eternity, a church made up of all people of all nations, and now a redeemed ethnic Israel who will become, as it were, the first among the first order of all the believers of all the ages. Now, notice something here. This is all the way into heaven, the new heaven and the new earth. Classic dispensational theology teaches that there will always be a distinction between the church and Israel. Always. They will both always be the people of God, but they will never be the same thing. All right? They were distinct here, here, and they will remain distinct forever. That's classic dispensational theology. All right? Any questions about that? So there's our dispensations. And what we mean by that is, who are the people of God during those people, during that period? Let me see if I can answer that when we get to progressive dispensationalism, because you'll see there's a difference there, and then we'll try to address that. The question was, is there a reason why they need to remain distinct? Is there a purpose in that? there is a purpose why this should happen. In other words, if he had asked me, is there a reason why we need a tribulation? The answer is yeah, because we need to reestablish an ethnic Israel who is actually a true Israel. But the second question, the question he actually asked, is much tougher. Do we still have to have it even into eternity? Is there a reason for that? And that's a tougher question. I'll try to answer that when we get to the next dispensational view. All right, here's what Charles Ryrie wrote, and by the way, would be considered by many the father of classic dispensational theology regarding the church. This, the distinction between Israel and the church, is probably the most basic theological test of whether or not a person is a dispensationalist, and it is undoubtedly the most practical and conclusive. The one who fails to distinguish between Israel and the church consistently will inevitably not hold to dispensational distinctions, and one who does will. Let me say that a different way. With the prominence that Dr. John MacArthur has enjoyed over the years, one of the questions he'll get inevitably every year at the Shepherd's Conference, where there's 3,000 to 5,000 pastors together, is, are you a dispensationalist? And his response is really this: turn the opposite direction. And here's how he says it always. It's like he pushes a play button. If what you mean by that is there a future for Israel, yes. There is a future for Israel, he's saying he believes, and based on that definition, I am a dispensationalist. Ryrie's saying the same thing in reverse. A dispensationalist has to believe that. Dr. MacArthur is saying, I believe that. If that makes me a dispensationalist, then it makes me a dispensationalist. But the brand, the label, means nothing particularly to him. What does mean something to him is that Israel has a future. All right? Well, let's see if we can defend that. Number one, the Bible makes it clear that the church is a distinct new group that did not exist until Christ. In Matthew 16, for instance, Jesus said to Peter, I will build my church. He did not say, I have been building my church. And therefore, the idea that the church is just the new Israel, or remember, most if not all careful replacement theologians believe that Israel was also the church. So that goes both directions, that there was no distinction ever, that Israel was the church of God of old, and we're the Israel of new, and that there was never a distinction. And this text would say, yeah, I'm going to build something that I haven't built yet. So that's the first argument. Secondly, God's promise to Abraham's physical descendants, who would possess the land forever, was an unconditional promise. He promised his descendants that they would possess land forever. Now let's read this. Now you don't have this, and rather than have us go through the Bible, I just brought this because I want you to see this text. Now many of you would know that in Genesis chapter 12, God makes a promise to Abraham. The covenant is in Genesis chapter 12, and it's restated again in Genesis chapter 15 when Abraham begins to doubt. So this is the second statement of that covenant. And there was that scene where God puts Abraham to sleep, right? They had cut the animals in two, and he puts Abraham to sleep. Then God walks through the middle. The picture being that I alone can keep this covenant. And we're picking up now at that point. The sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. And then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. What did he just predict? Israel's bondage in Egypt for 400 years. Now here's a question that you want to ask yourself. Remember, we're trying to answer inevitably, what is our view of the church in Israel? One of the questions is, how do I read texts like that? Is that literal? Did that literally happen? Yes, we know literally they were there for 400 years. So that's a prophecy, and we don't read it differently because it's a prophecy. We don't suddenly think 400 years doesn't mean 400 years. It meant 400 years, and that's a prophecy we actually saw happen, and we just studied it in the book of Exodus. All right, but I will bring judgment on the nation. That's Egypt, that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Did that happen? It happened. I won't belabor that, but this is important to those of you that really want to work through this on your own or in the times that we visit it. How am I supposed to interpret my Bible? You interpret it with the way it says it, unless there's a strong, compelling reason not to, and to say, well, it's prophecy, so now those rules don't apply. Well, they clearly applied here, and this is clearly prophecy. This hasn't happened yet when he's talking to Abram. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your offspring I give this land. And then he defines the land. Now, great work, and we will not do any of that great work, has been work to try to draw that boundary around that land to say this is what God promised. And then inevitably the reason is, did they ever have that? Because if they never had that, then they still are going to have that. All right, so that becomes important. But notice that there's no conditions to this promise. He just simply says to Abraham, this is what I will do. All right, now we can look to Ezekiel, which we will. And Ezekiel's prophesying and says, say to them, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the people of Israel from the nations among which they have gone. Now, like Abram telling Abram, this is what's going to happen to my people. They're going to go to Egypt 400 years, I'm going to bring them back, and then I'm going to give them this land. Now he's telling Ezekiel something farther in the future. Now they've been dispersed to all nations, and he says, I'm going to bring them back. I will bring them back from which they have gone, and will gather them from all around, and I will bring them to their own land. And the question now becomes, is this prophecy? Everybody knows Ezekiel's prophecy. Then are we to interpret this differently? That somehow this isn't really land, and it isn't really the Jews? Because if we interpret this differently, then we got to go back and visit the whole Abrahamic covenant again. I'll make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king over them all, and they shall be no longer two nations and no longer divided into two kingdoms. Remember, Ezekiel's prophesying during a period when the division had already happened. So not only am I going to fix that breach, but there's a greater scattering that's going to happen, and I'm going to fix that one too. I'm going to bring them all back together again. They shall not defile themselves anymore with their idols and their detestable things or with their transgressions. I will save them from all the backslidings in which they have sinned and will cleanse them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. My servant David shall be king over them. And now suddenly we say, well, what about your rule here, Steve? Because David's clearly dead. Well, that's an easy one, because that's a prophecy that is answered for us by both King David himself, when he makes himself, not himself, but rather Christ. And then in the New Testament, where at the first day of Pentecost, Peter's sermon said, you're still looking for David. Go check his tomb. The bones are there. He's still dead. This is your Messiah. Christ is that David. All right, so there are times when prophecy isn't so literal, but in those times the Bible tells us how to interpret it. And they'll have one shepherd, they'll walk in my rules, they'll be careful to obey my statutes, and notice, they'll dwell in the land. And then, verse 26, I'll make a covenant of peace with them, and it'll be an everlasting covenant. I no longer am going to treat them with dispersion. I'm no longer going to treat them with derision. They're not going to be separated from me anymore. I'm going to make a final and full and complete peace with them. And in verse 26, I'll set them in their land, and I'll multiply them, and I will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. And we're tiptoeing here now to Ross Stern's question. Is there a reason why Israel must remain distinct forever? And part of it goes back to these promises that see a national Israel forever, a national kingdom centered with the temple of God forever. All right, so there is reason to see that Israel needs to be distinct forever. My dwelling place will be with them. I'll be their God. They shall be my people. Then the nations will know that I am the Lord who sanctifies Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. Now, you could look all those other passages up, and you really could read your eyes tired on all the promises that God connects back to Abraham unconditionally that say, I will have a people, ethnic, national people, and they will have a land. Number three. The promise God made to Abraham to give physical descendants who would possess the land forever can only be fulfilled by ethnic Israel. Now, this is probably the most important slide up here, and one that for most people, unless you've really dug into this, you miss it. Not because it's complicated. It's really very simple, and it's what the classic dispensationalist or progressive dispensationalist, anybody who believes there's a future for Israel, would say this is the one that drives it in. Because here's the argument. All of those promises could be realized by a spiritual Israel, which could be the church. And I would say, yeah, could be. Could be just spiritual. It really makes my biblical interpretation principles challenged, but it could be that. And it could just be spiritual, and it could be fulfilled by the church. Unless there is one text or one inference somewhere that says, there is no way possible that God would ever let it be something other than ethnic or national Israel. And this is that text, all right? So watch this text. Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield and the one who will reward you. Now watch this. This is before the restatement of the covenant, the splitting it. All right, we're back earlier in chapter 15. Well, now follow this carefully. I am your shield and the one who will reward you in great abundance. But Abram said, O sovereign Lord, what will you give me since I continue to be childless and my heir is Eliezer of Damascus? Now, what did Abram just say? God, you made a promise with me, and I'm not doubting you. I'm just thinking maybe what you meant was it could happen a different way. Maybe what you meant was not actually my seed, ethnic, but someone in my house, someone under the covenant promise, someone like Eliezer of Damascus, not a Jew, not a descendant of Abraham. Abram added, since you've not given me a descendant, then look, one born in my house will be my heir. Abram's saying what we like to say, maybe you meant a spiritual progeny. Maybe you meant that this promise could be realized from some other path other than ethnicity. Maybe that's possible. But look, the word of the Lord came to him. This man will not be your heir, but instead a son who comes from your own body will be your heir. And then he said, let me tell you one more time, this is a promise I made with you, this is a promise I will keep with you, and I don't care that you're 100 years old and that it's impossible for it to happen, it must happen that way. And so, the classic or progressive dispensational would say, there is simply no room in the Bible to allow for any other ethnicity or spiritual manifestation of God's people to benefit from these promises. If that were possible, God would have said, sure, that's fine, Eliezer will work. And we all know to what extent God went then with Abram and Sarah to give them a child and the extent to which he has gone throughout history to maintain Israel. You know, one of the strongest arguments for the dispensational argument is not just 1948, but the fact that the whole world learned that in 1948 they weren't gone, that God had kept them despite all that they had been through. He has kept them. No other nation has had that kind of tenure ever in humankind, ever. And so this would be a really, really strong argument that if you could read Abram's promises to mean any other fulfillment other than ethnic, he would have allowed that here. And instead, he does his greatest miracle, one of his greatest miracles here, the monergistic promise to keep the covenant and then granting Abraham and Sarah a son long after they were able to have a child. All right, Paul clearly sees a future for ethnic Israel that is distinct from that of the church, Romans 11. So I ask, God has not rejected his people, has he? God hasn't forgotten his promise, has he? Absolutely not. In fact, Paul would say, look at me, I'm an Israelite. I'm a descendant of Abraham from the tribe of Benjamin. So he clearly hasn't forgotten Israel. Now, the point of this is to see what does Paul think about when he thinks about Israel. Does he think about a spiritual Israel, or is he talking here about an ethnic Israel? The answer is obvious. I hope it's obvious to you. He's making an ethnic defense, a national defense, not a spiritual defense. So then in verse 25, I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery. I understand it's a mystery and still has been a mystery for years because what happened to Israel? Brothers and sisters, so that you may not be conceited, a partial hardening has happened to Israel. And the thing is, just be consistent here. What Israel? Ethnic Israel. My national identity. A partial hardening has happened to Israel until the full number of the Gentiles has come in. So in other words, back to dispensations, I had my people. My people rejected their prophet. They killed their king. And I have, as a response to that, partially hardened them for a dispensation of time, a period of time, until I'm finished bringing in all the other nations, which we would say is the church. And so then, all Israel will be saved. When? After this current dispensation of the Gentiles. How will they be saved? The deliverer will come out of Zion. He'll remove ungodliness from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. In other words, I will keep my promise, and while it bears physical manifestation, it will always essentially be about their salvation. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to save them. I'm going to forgive them. And in regard to the gospel today, they're enemies, right? Are Jews friendly to the Christian gospel? Not at all. They're your enemies. But in regard to election, in regard to the promise I made, in regard to my choice I made of them before time, they are dearly loved for the sake of the Father. And now he expresses his own character. when I promise a gift, when I issue a call or elect, it's irrevocable. So we would just simply say, or those who see a future for Israel would simply say, the Apostle Paul clearly understands it and would understand it better than we, and he clearly sees a future for Israel. He sees a time when they're not and a time when they will be again. And yes, it is a spiritual saving, but it's a spiritual saving of a nation, of an ethnic race of people, his people. All right, let's talk about progressive dispensationalism. All right, you kind of got the dispensational view. Essentially, we're just saying, I told you I'd give you the simple part, not the technical part. Your question is what? Is there a future for Israel? Does the Bible make a promise to Israel that has not yet been met? And if so, in a few weeks, we'll talk about how God might meet it eschatologically. Well, what's different about progressive dispensationalism? Well, it's the newest one yet, right? Okay, so we're getting closer and closer to time. But as you start to consider Israel and that she may need to be distinct from the church and that you have all these promises need to be realized, well, now there's more theological think around this than there ever had been in the history of the church. You got lots of theological think going on, a lot of biblical interpretation, a lot of really careful study of the text, a look at God's providence, a look at God's dispensations. How does he deal with people? How has he dealt with humankind? What's the total picture of redemption across eternity? And try to make all this make sense, make it hum, so it doesn't have burrs that always seem like they're out of sync. And that has developed from classic dispensationalism, a nuance here. And it's very, very small, but it's pretty significant. Here's the belief. The church is the body of believers indwelt by the Holy Spirit, same thing. Distinct from Israel, same thing. Began on the day of Pentecost, same thing. But ethnic Israel and the church will be one people of God, as we all benefit from the covenants that have been progressively fulfilled and broadened throughout the ages. Here's the difference. There is not a constant distinction. In the future, they will come together as one. And so that Christian Gentile today who says, well, what promises do we get? If Israel gets all the promises, what promise do we get? And the progressive dispensationalist says, all those promises. Because in the future, there will be one people of God. Distinct, first, Israel. Distinct, now, the church. Distinct, future, Israel. And then non-distinct, one people of God. And it looks like this in a dispensational view. There was ethnic Israel. They rejected Christ, which brought in the church of believing Gentiles and believing Israel. Men like the Apostle Paul and Peter and all the early Christians were Jews. Then there's the tribulation and the millennial kingdom, which is all about ethnic Israel. All of that's about establishing and realizing the promises on this earth, a throne of David, which Christ will sit upon. But after the rapture, the church joins in that millennial celebration. The church is a part of that millennial celebration. We're a part of that reconstituted and redeemed earth. We'll live on this earth where the lion will sleep with the lamb, and if a man dies at 90, it will be said of him that he died at an early age. There'll be longer life and more fruitfulness and larger families and less sin and all these type of things that we read about in the millennial kingdom. There are our blessings to share with Israel. That's the kingdom age. And then we will become one people of God when at the end of that literal 1,000 years, the new heaven and the new earth with one people of God will last for all eternity. So that's the subtle distinction, is that the distinction is not maintained throughout all eternity. Now, Rostern had asked, is there a reason to maintain it? There's a couple of things that come into view. Number one, if God has maintained a distinction, one that we wrestle with but is clearly there, and one that we will never fully understand how it's all going to flesh out, then we would need a compelling text that says that in the future we all become one. Otherwise, we just need to rest in the fact that we are all the people of God but will always be distinct. So this becomes an argument almost from silence unless you can prove that we one day will become one people of God. And then again, as we pointed out already, when you look at the promises that God made to Abraham and add to them the promises he made to David, they have eternal value. They are seen to last forever, and there's argument that they should be distinct. But here, we don't see that argument, and let's compare a couple of things now and see if we can make this make sense. By the way, 1 Corinthians 15, I didn't bring the text, is where we would say was when Paul teaches of the resurrection, There was the first resurrection, and there's the second resurrection, the resurrection of Christ, the resurrection of the saints. He then says that all becomes one. We become all in one. And one interpretation there is that's that future coming together of one people of God. No longer any distinction. Outside of that, it's just a matter of how you want to view the future, because I would say God's been silent on it as to whether or not they must be distinct. All right, back up here. Here is the bottom is replacement theology. There's Israel and there's the church, period. It's simple. It was Israel, now it's the church, and it will be the church for all of ages. Tonight you learned about this, progressive dispensationalism, where there's one people of God, a shared benefit during the 1,000 years, but there is reason for every one of these ages. By the way, you see here, there's no reason for tribulation and millennium here because they only exist for Israel. And if Israel's gone, there's no reason to have them. Now, I'm saying this by reminder, but we'll get to this. When you get to the book of Revelation, then you have to decide, how am I going to interpret this book? And what we tend to do is we interpret it based on our theological perspective. So replacement theologians, because this is their doctrine of the church, never read Revelation to be dealing with Israel. They've already settled that issue. So they read Revelation completely different, through a completely different lens than these people read Revelation. In many cases, this is an old argument. It's really not true anymore, but it had a lot of weight a few years ago. They just don't read it at all. That's an easy way, just don't read it. And that's really not fair. By the way, that charge comes from, really, John Calvin, who had the time in his life, by God's grace, to write a lot of commentaries and just never got around to Revelation. And because Reformed theology shares the Calvinistic brand, they say, well, John didn't read it. We don't have to read it either. And there's really nothing to suggest John didn't read Revelation. But anyway, that's how that goes. Now, compare progressive dispensation with classic dispensationalism, and you'll see this is the only distinction. Is there going to be two people or one people? Does that all make sense? Okay. It's not as complicated as we contend to make it. Really, we've always, through 2 weeks now, been asking one question. Is there a future for Israel? Now, here's the follow-up to that. Do you care? I'm just curious. Why would you care? Why should we care whether or not, I'm not saying what you believe, why should we care whether or not there is? I mean, we're not Israel. None of us are Jews. Why should we care? There's not a right or wrong answer here. Why do you care? Yeah, that's a fair answer. If God cares, we should care. Yeah, that's the most common answer. That's really, I was trying to kind of fish that out of you guys a little bit. Not that that's the right answer. The most common answer is, because what you do about this says what you believe about God's promises. It impacts how you read God's promises. If God made an unconditional promise, and now suddenly it's become conditioned by Israel's rejection and been supplanted by the Gentiles in the church without any real document to say that he's changed his mind, and that suddenly the land is not the land, then you really are, you're toying with his promises. And that's the most common answer. In fact, you'll hear that, at least I heard it growing up here, you know, say, does Israel have a future? The answer was, does God keep his promises? It's like, okay, class dismissed. Let's go home. He either made the promises or he didn't. That's really interesting. Did you understand what Craig said? From a Calvinistic or Reformed position, really a linchpin of that entire theological construct doesn't start with the doctrine of the church. It starts with the doctrine of salvation, and that God, before time, elected those who would be his own, and among those were Israel. Then those same Reformed convicted people need to revisit this notion that suddenly there's not a future for Israel, because if they were elect, then they are elect. What's interesting about that, first of all, I think I agree with that, that's important. But a few years ago, some of you remember, at the Shepherd's Conference in California, Dr. MacArthur preached the opening sermon, which suddenly got like worldwide response the next day, and incredible criticism, and really led to a division between even now who's invited to the Shepherd's Conference to preach and who isn't, because his sermon was essentially what Craig just said, why every well-meaning Calvinist has to be a premillennialist is what he was teaching, but has to believe in a future for Israel. The argument was simply that your theology is inconsistent. Your doctrine of election and the eternality of God's covenant promises demand that you believe there's a future for Israel. And it really became a discussion of hermeneutics. How is it that you suddenly interpret your Bible differently? And that challenge was kind of leveled. I happened to be there that year, and it didn't really slap me in the face, but it slapped people in the face. There were nasty words on the walls and everything. It was pretty troubling to some people. Yeah, and you know, that's we focus tonight. When you focus on this question, you camp in Romans 9, 10, 11, because it's where Paul tries to answer the questions we're answering. He tries to answer them. He's pretty careful about it, and I think he's abundantly clear about it, and that's why I think there's a future for Israel. We looked at the text tonight, Romans 11, 25 and following. But it's also Romans where he asks and answers this question: what advantage then to being a Jew? Right? What's the advantage? And Craig kind of just summarily stated it. Huge advantage. God chose them as a nation to be the vehicles that would produce the Word of God, the model and the principles and standards that would govern the people of God, not just the model that we follow today, but this will be the model that we will follow for all eternity. They were designed to be that beacon of hope and light to all the nations, and he made that choice. And so it really is a serious deal. That's why I said in my introduction, inevitably you have to settle this in your mind, or there will be aspects of your Christian faith and the promises God has made to you that will trip you up when things don't go well. And if we don't have the lesson of Israel, that despite all of their golden calf debauchery, God still keeps his promise, then there's every reason to wonder whether he'll keep his promises that he's made to you. So it is a huge, huge issue, way more important than how we think it's all going to end, because it impacts your daily relationship with God. Here's just another way of looking at it. We won't dwell on that. Now, you have one more thing in your book called Progressive Covenantalism, a slightly different model. We're not going to give that any attention, not because anything wrong with it, but it just seeks to kind of restate this with some nuance. Again, more people pour attention on this, these little nuances come out. What this seeks to do is say that God hasn't really followed certain periods of time, but that he's made promises, and those promises are telescoping, and they get bigger and greater and include and reach out and include more people. So the first promise was Adam and Eve. And then even through their sin, it expanded it. And then through Noah, it expanded it. And then through Abraham, it expanded it to Israel. Through Moses, Israel got a national identity. Through David, they get a kingship forever. And then it expands, even in Israel's rejection, to include the church. But it's always the promises of God. So it's just dispensationalism, removing that really troublesome word and supplanting it with one that Reformed people in particular are more comfortable with, and that's covenant. So you follow God's promises, and you just see that they just keep reaching out and grabbing more and more people until inevitably all the elect become the people of God. And you can study that on your own. This is our summary, and I'll cut you loose. What are the differences that we've learned between Israel and the church? What are the differences? Well, Israel's identity was an ethnic identity, and it was governed by the law. The church's identity is a universal spiritual identity, and it's governed by grace. Now, don't hear me say that Israel was saved by the law. We're talking about, as a people of God, how did God relate to them? How did he govern them? And he clearly governed Israel through the law. And he was teaching them something there, that they always needed grace, but it's how he related to his people. 2 Corinthians 3, 5 says, "Not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as if it were coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who made us adequate to be servants of a new covenant, not based on the letter," which was that covenant, "but based on the Spirit," which is this covenant. The letter kills, and it killed Israel, and the Spirit gives life to the church. That's the idea. Okay? Also, the law changes people from the outside in. And again, we know that that's not how people are changed, but as it regards his relationship to his people, he introduced a moral code by which they would live their lives and become distinct. He says to them, "If you will keep my laws, you will be different from every other nation." And in that sense, he was changing their behavior from the outside in. All right, so don't, again, our minds just race to salvation, and we're not talking about that. We're talking about how he brought about change that was distinct. How does he bring about change now? From the inside out. And he doesn't identify us nationally anymore. He doesn't identify us ethnically. He identifies us now by the law of grace, or the law of love, and we've spent a lot of time studying that over the years. So there's the differences. Also here, Israel's functional relationship with God was based on the law. Here, our functional relationship with God is based on forgiveness through Christ. Now we have to be careful over here. We have to be careful over here that we don't just throw away the law. Because there is a function of our Christian life, even though it's grounded in grace, fueled and motivated by the love of God through the Spirit of God in us, it is still directing us toward the law. And we've been studying that also just in recent weeks. Israel had a unity under a national theocracy, national identity governed by God. We have a unity under a spiritual theocracy. We don't have a national identity. We have a universal identity of all those who are believers in Christ, and He is our head. That's the way we would be different. How are they similar? By the way, 1 Peter says the same thing of Israel that of the church that was said of Israel. He's speaking to the church when he says you're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people of His own. You once were not a people, but now you are God's people. And so Israel was God's chosen people, holy nation, and kingdom of priests. And Peter says we are the same thing. But of course, we know that that doesn't mean earthly nation, but a spiritual kingdom. Romans 3:28 says we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. This is important. How is Israel saved? Through faith. How is the church saved? Through faith. We're always saved through faith. All right. Look at the clock. This is amazing. No. 7 o'clock, but that clock's wrong, so we're actually behind probably. Any questions? What'd you learn tonight? Somebody tell me something in one sentence. What'd you learn tonight? Do you think there's a future for Israel? I'm just curious if you think there is. Okay, you don't have to answer. Do you think there's a future for Israel? You do? Did you learn that tonight? Really? That's cool. Or maybe affirm that tonight? What'd you learn? Anything? So it's your tradition. Yeah. What about from a different tradition? Does any of this start to sing together? Like Craig, does this? Yeah, that's a good question. Now, what Craig just asked there was an eschatological question that we will answer. So what happens at the rapture? We would say First Thessalonians says that the dead in Christ will rise. Their body is now being united. So they have their resurrected bodies and are in heaven with Christ for 7 years, full, glorified, heavenly bodies. On the earth for that 7 years are just human beings that happened among them to be Jews who now become born again, many of which will die. Gentiles will come to be born again in that 7 years. They will die, and they're in heaven, but without their bodies. So there is a resurrection at the rapture. Then the millennial kingdom, the initial inhabitants of the millennial kingdom are the living Jews who weren't killed during the tribulation. So they're alive, flesh and blood. They just walk right into the kingdom and begin to enjoy the benefits of that kingdom. We come and join them with our glorified bodies. So in that millennial kingdom, you have flesh and blood human beings like us and glorified saints serving and living together in that millennial kingdom. But there's a final uprising and a final judgment where that millennial kingdom and the rest of the earth, for that matter, is laid waste, not annihilated, but Peter says will melt with a fervent heat. And then at that point, there's another resurrection, not for us, but the resurrection of all those saints who were just flesh and blood at that point. They will be transfigured, as it were. And then we come back to inhabit the new heaven and the new earth. So there's a mixture of flesh and blood and not flesh and blood, and it all gets confounding. Yeah. And that was an attempt to answer that other than to say, he asked an eschatological question, what's going to happen to us when we die? When is there a resurrection? Is there one resurrection or is there five resurrections? And if we think there's five, where do you get that idea from? Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you brought up R.C. Sproul because he hasn't been on the board yet because his is not really even classically reformed because he's a preterist or partial preterist, which is a view that we'll talk about in a few weeks. But so he's really unique. And then it becomes a head-scratcher. I mean, it's one thing to scratch your head to see how all the church for so many years didn't think of this, but then to take a man so well-learned and so study, and he's got a position on it that's distinct from just about anybody. I mean, would be really, really a small group of Christians who would embrace preterism, which means not only is there not a future for Israel, but that all of those promises and curses and everything have been fully realized. There's no future to any of the promises, period. There, it's over with. It was settled 70 AD when God annihilated Jerusalem. It ended Israel's future, and it resolved all of the curses that he had leveled against them. And once and for all, didn't put them on the shelf, but they're done. They have no identity. That's a very, very minute minority, very small minority that believe that. Yeah. Absolutely. I said in my introduction, there's nothing more confusing than this. There's nothing you'll study that's more confusing for this. And it is absolutely non-essential, and you certainly don't have to agree with my ramblings on it, but I do think it's important. I think what y'all would hope you'll learn out of this class is that you ought to think about these things. And if there's some simple cliches that'll help you. If it matters to you how it began, it ought to matter to you how it ends. Now, for a lot of Christians, they don't care about either one. They don't want to fight over Genesis, and they don't want to fight over Revelation. Just happy to say, well, in the middle, we belong. But that's a little cliche you'll hear. If you think it matters how it all began, then it ought to matter to you how it all ends. And I do think out of this class, I hope you'll be challenged to spend some time thinking about these things. But it's interesting, though, let me say this in Luther's defense, not that he needs my defense. But as you think through these things, being careful here is helpful. Now, what Craig said is historically, that's what people have accused him of. But you would never find him being anti-Jew. What you would find him being is pro-God. And if God is comfortable judging the Jews for rejecting him, then he's comfortable with that. And that sounds anti-Semitic, but it really is just saying, that's what I believe God did. In the same way, Christians today are charged with being like anti-loving. Because this morning I preached a sermon that says, you know what, the wrath of God abides on you if you're not a born-again believer. Well, I can be accused of not hating Jews. I'm accused of hating humans, right? Just humans. So that charge really becomes, in Luther's defense, and really all of Reformed theology, were so pro-God, and God had been so clear in his message proclaimed to the Jews, and they were so unequivocally clear in their rejection of him that they're very comfortable resolving there. They feel like they're standing on God's side. You would find, yeah, the thing, that's a hard one to answer, but what we can say for sure, it's hard to say what went on providentially in the heart and mind of a theologian somewhere that starts to read his Bible and seeing some things that others, for whatever reason, hadn't seen. What we can say for certain, though, is that for centuries, the Christian church understood their role as kingdom witnesses, their roles as proclaiming the gospel, and the future hope that they have of Christ returning and granting them what he promised them. And so there was no reason really to think about that. That's what we know for certain. We also know for certain that we don't have any old church fathers who wrote contrary to that. They were very comfortable with what Greg even said way long before Luther, going all the way back to the 3rd century, writing anti-Semitic sounding positions on Israel because they just thought God had judged Israel. There was no reason to think otherwise. So then you say, well, now we have all this discussion. I mean, there's prophecy seminars everywhere, and you can build a crowd. Just say you're going to teach Revelation. They'll come. You don't even have to get it right. They'll just come listen. And so you say, what caused all that? And the only marker we can see, other than we know that God providentially moves in mysterious ways, is the establishment of a nation. And suddenly we're asking a different set of questions. So I think that's it. Now, what the dispensationalist has, Craig said, you know, I think Craig just said that you have to start thinking about Israel differently. You can't be anti-Semitic now. But we have a problem in the dispensational camp, or anybody that sees a future for Israel, is you also can't embrace anything that calls itself Israel, right? Just because they got the Star of David on their flag doesn't have anything to do with the promises of God. We've already been through that once with Israel, and we know that most of them weren't Israel. And so, you know, either way, you just got to watch God work out his plan. And in the end, it'll be much clearer than it is today. No, he said he would trade his own salvation for the nation's salvation, not for an individual Jew that he happened to like. Paul clearly, I've never read a careful replacement theological argument that can argue away the Apostle Paul. The best they can do is say that the Apostle Paul believed there was a future for Israel. That's about as far as you can get. He clearly believed there's a future for Israel. But he could have been wrong on that. Like he was apparently wrong on a lot of other things, right? We better stop. But thanks for your interest. Stick with this. Stick with this. In 2 weeks from tonight, very practical. What is the purpose of the church? Why do we exist? We won't mention Israel. All right? So come back in 2 weeks.